Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Head to patreon.com/chasingEarhart to join the chase and become a patron today. Chasing Earhart, the discussion panel, is taking place in just over 2 months on Saturday, July 21st, 2018 in Atchison, Kansas, during the 22nd annual Amelia Earhart Festival. Go to chasingearhart.rsvpify.com. That's chasingearhart.rsvpify.com to reserve your seats for this historic panel event. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. Going on 81 years later, all over the world, lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
Ace.
Look, lady, could you get out of the way?
Lady? Who are you calling lady? The name is Amelia. Amelia Earhart. Perhaps you've heard of me?
Oh, right. You were like this famous pilot or whatever.
Pilot? I was the first woman to fly the Atlantic. First woman to receive the Flying Cross. First woman to fly across the 48 states in a gyroprop. And now if you'd wipe that perhaps permanent look of alarm off your kisser, I was wondering if you might be so kind as to tell me exactly where I am.
You're in a museum. Or actually under it. And I'm in kind of a dangerous situation right now, so you might not want to be anywhere near me. Wow, you're fast.
What's your name, Flyboy?
My name is Larry Daly.
Well, Larry Daly. In case you weren't listening, I'm not one to shy away from danger.
How about Spears? You want to shy away from Spears?
That's ankle, Skipper. Now we're going to have some fun.
Von Hardesty is a former curator at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. He has written widely on aerospace history. His books include Great Aviators and Epic Flights, Lindbergh, Flight's Enigmatic Hero, Air Force One, the aircraft that shaped the modern presidency, and Epic Rivalry, the inside story of the Soviet and American space race. On the 46th episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, Vaughn joins us via Zoom to discuss Amelia Earhart's impact and legacy, and the role that the Smithsonian plays in keeping that legacy alive 80 years after she disappeared. Our guest today on the Chasing Earhart podcast is Von Hardesty. He is a former curator at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. Von, this is an absolute pleasure. It's been something I've been wanting to do for a long time. Thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast today.
I'm delighted to be with you.
So let's start this interview the same way I've done all the other interviews that we've done. Can you tell me a little bit about your education and your professional background, please?
I came to the Air and Space Museum in 1979 as a research fellow. And my main menu for the next 3 decades was Russian and Soviet aeronautics. That's what I was primarily working in. But along the way, of course, your duties aren't that narrow. And I did a book for the Air and Space Museum called Great Aviators and Epic Flights, which was an illustrated account of some of the more memorable flights, mostly in the golden age of flight in the 20s and 30s. And so I was very much interested in not only Amelia Earhart, but also Amy Johnson, Valerie Chekhov, and some of those pioneers in the 20s and 30s. So I have a nodding acquaintanceship with Amelia Earhart and all the controversy that has swirled around her. One thing I think is so important, I think, for historians is to always be alert to historical context. You know, that old saying that everything that is new is faintly familiar. And I keep thinking of Nungesser and Coley, who in 1927 disappeared over the North Atlantic, never found their plane. But there was a lot of speculation, even search parties, to follow up on leads that the plane had made it to Newfoundland or Maine. And the frustrating thing is that some of these human witnesses appear credible, but nothing was ever found. And when I think of Amelia Earhart, we have the same sort of nagging problem, you know, that there's so much mystery associated with her fate, you know, what happened. And you're bounced around by some very credible, sincere researchers who are trying to seek out exactly what happened. And the other thing about historical context I just mentioned, because it comes to mind, is that in the summer of 1937, we had some extraordinary long-distance flights, and some were successful, like Valery Chkalov, Mikhail Gromov flying over the North Pole from Moscow, which is an extraordinary feat of aerial flying. They had problems with navigation. You know, magnetic compass doesn't work over the North Pole. And no one had ever flown over that perilous region before. And they made it. But then in August, after a Ameliard had disappeared, they tried a third attempt. And this time, they were flying a four-engine bomber prototype, the NT-6. And Levinsky and his six-man crew just disappeared. And somewhere over the Arctic coast of Alaska. And the Russians, although we kind of live in sealed-off universities, universes, they've made several attempts to try to find Levinsky's plane and enlisted the help of Canadians and Americans. And in the 1990s, they went up there and attempted to do that. And, of course, they faced the same sort of problem you face with Ameliard. You know, exactly where did this plane go down? Did it make landfall? Did it go down in the Arctic Ocean? And then you have these intriguing personal testimonies of people who heard the engine, or some even claimed they saw the plane going down. And did it sink in some sort of lagoon someplace? That has never been resolved either. So there is an extraordinary problem with these long-distance flights that end in tragedy, that they were routinely devoid of much in the way of artifacts. And there's a lot of speculation, and there's so much plausibility associated with various theories. You know, so that's the problem.
You know, it's interesting. You'd mentioned the disappearance, and you'd mentioned the Russian disappearance shortly after that. But I want to ask you, because I don't think I've ever asked this question, actually, but what did the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan do? Did that send shockwaves through the early aviation community like that? When that happened, we obviously know the worldwide impact, and it was such a big deal. But what did that do to the aviation community when they just disappeared, vanished into thin air?
Well, I think there was a shared sense of kind of horror with the public, you know, that this well-known and popular figure was just gone, and there was no trace of her. And she seemed to have, at first glance, all the necessary attributes to be a success. In 1932, she had made that solo flight across the Atlantic, which is no small feat. And she had on board arguably one of the best navigators, a Pan Am navigator, and Fred Noonan. Why didn't they make it? You know, what happened? I think it's fair to say that when you look more closely at Earhart, she also has evidence of some of the downside of golden age of flight flyers. Like Chkalov, she had a certain disdain for technology. There was no attention to detail. She'd never mastered the Morse code, but she had all the bravado and flamboyance of Chkalov, this boldness to fly over great distances. But there's a lack of attention to detail, and maybe this is a fateful error. Now, in Chkalov's case, in June of 1937, they flew to the North Pole. He had two crew members with him. And he benefited from the fact that Georgi Baidukov, who's a very skilled pilot, landed his plane at Vancouver near Portland. And he had Belyakov, who was a very talented navigator. So they picked up the slack, you know, where Chkalov was kind of ill-equipped by inclination to be a, you know, a detailed sort of guy. They filled the gap. I often think of look at the way Lindbergh prepared for his transatlantic flight. The extraordinary detail, the 25-mile increments on his map. And, you know, he was a person really given to total command of what was happening. You don't see that in Amelia Earhart. And it's kind of sad because she has all the bravado and skill of a golden age pilot. But it strikes me that there's a real lack of detail there.
You know, it's interesting. It's been argued by a lot of different folks, you know, experts in various fields, aviators and all the like, that Amelia Earhart was or was not a good pilot. A lot of people say that, you know, she was an extraordinary pilot. I think it's interesting that, you know, I think there was something like 22 landings before the disappearance, and every one of those landings was in obviously a different country, a different continent in a lot of cases, multiple types of landings on different terrain, and she was able to land that with no problem. You know, she's walked away from 11 crashes. I mean, she was obviously highly experimental back in the day. But what I want to know from you, just this is just your opinion, but do you believe that Amelia Earhart herself was a good pilot or a good enough pilot to take on this monumental task of flying around the world equatorially like this?
I do. My former boss at the Air and Space Museum, Don Lopez, who was a World War II ace and a test pilot, I remember talking to him once about Amelia Earhart, and his opinion was that she's a poor pilot. She just lacked the aptitude. But then, but when I look at 1937 and look at the terrain she covered prior to her disappearance and landing in New Guinea, of all places, I mean, there's a skill set there. I don't know. When I think about great aviators, and then you look at astronauts, we couldn't have done any better with Neil Armstrong, this cold, calculating, disciplined man who was never intimidated by crises. I don't know, a lesser skilled, lesser disciplined pilot or astronaut might not have had the same success. So maybe Amelia Earhart is not a Neil Armstrong in that sense, but I think she's a credible pilot. And but I don't know, there's a difference of opinion about this.
You know, people seem to, and you touched on Neil Armstrong, who was another credible person, and you mentioned his lack of intimidation, not being intimidated by any kind of situation or crises. It's been argued by me that Amelia Earhart truly, really was, for all intents and purposes, fearless. I mean, if she was fearful of anything, I think that she was so great at masking that fear, just not showing it, at least outwardly. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you kind of would agree with that. Do you think that she was fearless? Do you think it took a fearless type of person to kind of do the things that she did and take the risks that she took?
Well, maybe the way for us to comprehend this, yes, she is fearless. She has a skill set, but it's this inattention to the technology, which was advancing rapidly in the 30s. I just think how that would have enhanced her capabilities and extended her prowess as a pilot if she would have, you know, been that attentive. I don't know. There is such a thing as the right stuff. It's a mysterious, ethereal sort of thing, but I think it's really real. I mean, there are some people who just possess a skill, a boldness, a presence of mind. I don't know how you describe it. I remember interviewing, since I did a book on the air war on the Eastern Front in World War II, I interviewed a lot of German pilots. I had many conversations with Gunther Rahl, who was this extraordinary ace, went 275 victories. And some of the exploits that he was involved with, that he would talk to you about, not in terms of bragging, but just kind of descriptive. I just thought, how many pilots, men or women, could have handled that kind of extraordinary stress, you know, being shot down 6 or 7 times, and mid-air collisions. I mean, just living on the edge. So there is that quality. So maybe when we look at Amelia Earhart, we ought to ask ourselves, to what degree does the persona of the right stuff reflect in her? And I don't think she was totally possessed by this phenomenon. I doggedly hold on to the fact that she was a capable pilot in many ways.
Let's talk a little bit about Fred Noonan, because I know he gets lost in a lot of this, and we're getting ready to hopefully talk with Jackie Ferrari, who's a walking, talking encyclopedia on Fred Noonan, which we're excited about. But I want to know if, I guess from the Smithsonian, from the Air and Space Museum's point of view, what is their position on Fred Noonan, and what is your personal position on Fred Noonan? I mean, he was, I've always believed that he was, you know, if you're going to do a flight of this magnitude, that's the guy that you want to have in the cockpit with you or in the navigator station with you. That's the guy. But I mean, can you kind of expand a little bit about Fred Noonan's kind of role in the flight and who he was as a person and as a navigator?
First, about the Air and Space Museum, I think people like Dorothy Cochran and Tom Crouch and others, long-term curators, have always been honest and straightforward. But they've always been skeptical too. I mean, and they've got to be careful in that context. You know, when the Smithsonian puts its imprimatur in something, it has carries great authority. And in the absence of conclusive evidence on many of these issues, you have to be very careful. I think Elgin Long has been appealing to many people in the museum because of his manifest skills in navigation and flying. And his account is a simple, but perhaps the most plausible as you look at it. But there's no official Smithsonian posture. Now, Fred Noonan, as I remember, rarely came up. There was always this there was this pro forma acknowledgement, you know, that he was a skilled navigator, and you look at his career. But then there's this undertow of anxiety about the man, you know, the purported drinking and what have you. I don't know. The one thing, as an observer, maybe you have an answer to this too. Has anyone ever written about the onboard communication between Amelia and Noonan? You know, I've often wondered, you know, what sort of conversations transpire? Would she, as pilot in command, always have the option to say yay or nay on anything Noonan suggested?
You know, that's a good question. There's been a lot of speculation, of course. I think they had a really good professional relationship. I think Amelia respected Noonan a lot. I think, you know, she respected his thoughts and his opinion, especially on navigation. I think that's one of the reasons why, I know you touched on it earlier, that when it comes to the shooing the technology away at the time and not doing that, her response is, well, I have the best navigator in the world, and that's what he's there for, to help me with. And I think as far as the communications, you know, they had, there was obviously, it was widely talked about how they had the little string pulley rope thing where they would, you know, Fred Noonan would pass notes back and forth to mm-hmm. Amelia and vice versa. I imagine that when he wasn't in the cockpit, and there's no evidence to really explain this, but I think when he wasn't in the navigator station, rather, I think he would probably join her up front in the cockpit when they knew, especially when they knew where they were going, and they didn't, you know, when they didn't have to really worry about navigating for a little while. I think their relationship was pretty good. I think they communicated pretty well throughout the whole process. And you know, it's interesting when you talk about the drinking and you talk about all that stuff. You know, Amelia despised alcohol. She didn't. It wasn't a thing because of her issues with her father when she was a young girl. She even didn't even serve it in Toluca Lake, and she was, you know, hanging out yeah. with, you know, the Hollywood elite at the time. She was a tomato juice and hot cocoa kind of girl. That's just kind of the way she was. And I think if Fred had been fall down drunk or had really just not been, you know, on his A game, I think she would have just simply left him, especially at Lay at that point. I think that they would have had a falling out. I mean, on the friendship flight, she didn't stand for it. I don't think she would have on the world flight. So I guess to answer your question, I think they were constantly communicating. I think they sat together on times of non-navigation. I think that they communicated throughout the flight, and I think they had a really healthy mutual respect for each other. They might not have agreed with each other on everything, but I think that Amelia ultimately valued Fred's opinion, and I think that she took it into consideration anytime he made a recommendation. I mean, but again, it's speculation because we don't know, obviously. But for the most part, I think they had a really good, solid relationship.
Yeah, I suspect that. I guess he's compared unfavorably with Paul Mass, who was the prior navigator, who had none of the downfall of personality. So I don't know. Recently, I did some research on Pan Am and that clipper that got caught on its way to New Zealand on the day of Pearl Harbor, and how all these guys managed to fly back to the United States, going east to west. And it really struck me how capable Pan Am people were, pilots, navigators. I mean, this was the cream of the crop. I mean, to participate in Pan Am, you had to have the requisite skills. So Noonan's in that body of Pan Am specialists, which should not be neglected as an important factor.
You know, as someone who was a former curator, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about just the experience of that position and maybe how Earhart sort of ties into that. I know they have my very favorite Earhart plane, the Vega, at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. And I wonder if you have any stories you can recall about just people talking to you about, you know, the Smithsonian's display with the Vega, and just people, fans of Earhart and people that were kind of inspired by her example, kind of talking to you about it, or you having conversations with other folks. Can you expand on any of that for us?
Curators at the Air and Space Museum have aircraft and areas of museum operation that they're responsible for. And around you are docents and volunteers. So every year you give updated history lectures so these people are properly informed. So there's a real organic link of yourself with the collection. And the Vega is a striking, beautiful plane. It's up on the second floor there, the Pioneers Gallery. It's still there. And, it's just an extraordinary piece of aeronautical technology. One thing the curators would do periodically was, like once called a curator's choice, and it was, here are the expert or whatever. And they would periodically go down on the main floor, go to a specific gallery near an aircraft or some display, and then give a little lecture on what is there and answer questions. It's a wonderful tradition because the public has a chance to see the artifact and then interact with someone who's responsible for it. I think the curatorial staff was routinely and uniformly respectful of everything that was there and keen on understanding it. But there's a built-in inertia in the curatorial staff, understandably, that, whenever you say anything, you have to be cautious and you have to have your own attention to detail. You have to have your own authoritative basis to speak. Now, when David Horner did his book, I couldn't, as a curator or as a historian, endorse all of his conclusions. But I encouraged him. I said, someone like you needs to bring together all the background and plausible evidence for an alternate theory on what happened to Amelia Earhart. And I said, you'll do yourself and everyone a great service by doing that. So I think the Air and Space Museum at its heart should be a place where you encourage scholarship. Now, maybe that David Jordan, if he goes back for another, maybe they'll find the plane. And I'm haunted by the fact, until we find that damn plane, we just don't know. I heard someone comment that where the plane would have gone down, according to Elgin and Lawrence, is extreme depths. Just to retrieve the plane would be a daunting task. And the one interesting aspect, I don't know if this has been confirmed, they said if the plane sunk at those depths, it would not be overwhelmed with barnacles and vegetation. So it would be very much, the only effects it would have would be just the pressure of the water. That's a fascinating thing to speculate about it, if we could find it. And I'm encouraged too, that after all those decades, they did find the Titanic finally. And it was absolutely stunning once you got to see it. So maybe the Electra will be found. I hope so. But anyway, getting back to the curators, they're a cautious lot, and understandably, why they are. And I think they're the typical. I know my colleagues. There's always an element of encouragement to help researchers, regardless of their viewpoint. I know Yuri Salnikov and these people from Moscow were looking for Levinsky. We did, at least I did, as the Russian specialist, did everything I could to support their effort, not knowing what, if anything, they'd ever find. But that's the attitude.
You've been talking about Levinsky and his plane and his voyage, and I'm wondering, because I know you and I talked a little bit before the show about some of the similarities really between that and the world flight with Earhart and Noonan. Can you sort of touch on that for our listeners out there? Because this is a story that a lot of our listeners maybe aren't familiar with and would love to get more intimately familiar with themselves. Can you touch on some of the similarities between the Levinsky's flight and Amelia's flight and kind of the disappearances?
That's a very good question, because I think anyone who's trying to comprehend Amelia Earhart and what happened to her, you have to understand the world she lived and worked in. And this was an era of aerial spectaculars. Lindbergh, of course, touched it off with his phenomenal flight. But in the decade that followed, there was all kinds of efforts by various nations to set new records for altitude, speed, distance. And the Soviets got enamored with this too. They sponsored Chkalov in June and Gromov in July on these successful transporter flights, which are just phenomenal feats of flying. But then Levinsky, with a different type of airplane, instead of a single engine, he had a multi-engine plane, big plane. He tried it in August and disappeared with his crew. Levinsky is an interesting guy. He's Polish background. He had supported the Bolshevik Revolution. Interestingly, he was very much involved in rescuing Jimmy Mattern, who was an American Golden Age pilot who was flying up near the Arctic Circle. So he could speak English. He was known to Americans. And the Army Air Corps at the time took a real interest in Chkalov and Gromov and Levinsky because their airplanes were truly unique. I mean, there's no comparable type in the United States. And we were always interested in their manifest skill at cold weather flying. And at Wright Field in Dayton, I discovered this huge set of files by military attaches and various commentators on how the Soviets could fly aircraft in incredibly cold temperatures. So we were interested in them from that standpoint.
I want to ask you about something that's really interesting because, we were talking with, you mentioned David Jordan earlier. We were talking with Tom Vinson a few weeks ago, and he's a former engineer for Rockwell Collins, and he worked with, his team worked with Nauticos to work out some of the formulas and some of the math and the engineering in the world flight. And he had mentioned something towards the end of our conversation I thought was very sort of beautiful and poetic, and I wanted to get your take on that. And that is, if they find the plane, or when they find the plane, I should say, and they're able to successfully extract the plane, he would like, personally, to see, the plane finish the world flight. He would like to see it towed kind of, maybe to Hawaii and then from Hawaii to Oakland where she was going to land and finish the world flight. Yeah. So kind of, finish her flight for her. And then at that point, maybe not ever restore it, just keep it in the condition that it's found and maybe have it find a home in the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, maybe next to the Vega or something like that. And I thought, I can't imagine the impact that would have for visitors and patrons of the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum to see Amelia Earhart's, triumphant Vega that she, broke this record in and did this incredible flight in next to the Lockheed Electra, which would be something that would be, there really wouldn't be any word to describe how incredible that would be. What say you on that? Do you think that would be something, that's kind of a silly question, but do you think that would be something the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum would be interested in? And what do you think their viewpoint would be to have that finally have its resting place?
I've been away for a while, so I don't know who's in charge. I can't speak for them, but it seems to me more as an outsider like you, my God, wouldn't you want that plane in the collection and find a place to display it? It's so historic and so monumental, and it closes a chapter. I hope they can find it. Maybe we'll live long enough to see that. I hope so.
It's interesting. I always ask this question to everybody, and I want to ask you, I think, as we sort of kind of wrap up the interview, one thing I want to ask you is there's so many aviation mysteries out there, that you've touched on one with Levinsky and his flight, and, they have Flight 19 and all these other incredible aviation mysteries, but is the Lockheed Electra 10E, is Amelia Earhart's, plane, her flying laboratory, is that the holy grail of aviation? If that were to be found, would that be considered the holy grail of aviation, do you think?
Yeah, arguably, I think it would be. I guess, Levinsky's plane is interesting, but for Western audiences, they don't even know who Levinsky is, and his airplane would be an obscure thing. Amelia Earhart is larger than life. There's so much social history intertwined with all this, too. Gender issues and all kinds of stuff. So it's a very very compelling thing. There is a magic to artifacts. I remember, just to relate this story, when I was joined the staff there as a junior curator in 81, I remember the desk I had was not a separate office, but it was in kind of a workroom off to the side. But one of the unanticipated benefits of being in this kind of remote place was there was a cabinet right next to me. And if you'd open the drawers, there was Charles Lindbergh's necktie, flashlight, matchbox. This stuff was within arm's reach. You just open the drawer and there it is. And I just remember how utterly enthralled I was to be in proximity to something like that. You know, the artifact has a magic of its own. And being around three-dimensional objects, being in a museum, of course, brings you into that. I remember walking around, working late at night, and then going home, and you'd walk down through the second floor or third floor of the museum, and there's these incredible aircraft, including the Vega, which you like, so just parked there. And you have to be pretty dull to miss the electricity of all of that. And I think that's the great thing about museums. I think people get frustrated with museums, and maybe with the Air and Space Museum too, is that they're caretakers of all this, but they're so slow to come down and say yay and nay on various theories. You know, they're just, and I understand that. But if you recovered that Electra, then we'll find out exactly what happened. You know, we can do the forensics on that thing and figure out, you know, in a fairly conclusive way, you know, what happened. But until that day comes, we're all kind of enthusiasts, but we're kind of awaiting the deus ex machina for God to intervene on this and tell us, you know, what happened. And I appreciate your website. I think you capture all the elan and interest in this, and so press on.
Well, thank you. We will. You know, the last question I want to ask you before we wrap up the interview is, why does everybody care so much? I love getting this. I love asking this question because we always get such great, you know, answers. But from your point of view, why as a country, as a world, you know, as the world, really as a worldwide audience, do we care so much about Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan going on 81 years after they mysteriously disappeared? Why does this grab us and continue to just swallow us whole as far as the disappearance and the legacy, really?
I don't know. There's probably many ways to answer that. I think when David Horner put the word enigma into the title of his book, that's the core of the whole thing. It's just, there's a mystery to this. And you want an answer, but it's not available. And then when you encounter all these theories, all have a plausibility. What about these, David Horner in his book tells the account of these Japanese veterans who returned to Saipan. And this one man was very distraught and guilt-ridden about that they had executed this woman, who could have been Amelia Earhart, you know, the description. It's so ethereal. It's not unlike UFOs or something. You know, there's something there, but, you know, what is there? You know, it's so perplexing. So I'm really much taken up with the mystery of all of this. But Amelia Earhart is a phenomenal historical person, and she touches the lyre on many of its strings. And you want to be honest about her, too. I arguably, I don't think she's the greatest pilot ever, but boy, she fits into the golden age of flight in a very convincing way.
What can I say? This has been, it's been enlightening. It's been educational. It's been a pleasure for me. Vaughn, thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast.
Well, I'm delighted, and press on with your work. I think what you're doing is fascinating.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Legacy Retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of the past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Schmidt, and narration is done by Chris Williamson. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated, all rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production, copyright 2018, all rights reserved. We'll be right back.